Please subscribe and leave a review of Dorky wherever you get your podcasts. Also, you can support the pod if you'd like. You can use PayPal or Buy Me a Coffee. There are links to both methods on Dorky's website and in the show notes of this episode. Thank you so much. Before the episode, let me tell you about an amazing online boutique that I just know you're going to love. Save Boutique is a great place for clothes, accessories, and shoes. One of the great things about Save is that it's size inclusive. Most items Save offers are available in sizes from small to 3X, and they're looking into ways to offer even more sizing options. They also drop new items every week, so there's always new things to choose from. They even offer three buy now, pay later options: Shop Pay, Klarna, and Afterpay. One last thing, they're offering a discount to Dorky listeners. Just enter the code Dorky, that's D-O-O-R-K-E-Y, all caps, no spaces, for a 10% discount. I even put a link to Save Boutique in the description notes of this episode that will take you directly there and automatically apply the discount. So check out the amazing clothes, accessories, and shoes Save Boutique has to offer. You'll be so glad you did. Hello, this is Dorky. I'm your host, April. This is a podcast about history. I'm going to be discussing events, people, and sometimes just random things from history that interest me. I am absolutely not a historian. I'm just a dork who spends a lot of time watching, reading, listening to anything I can get my hands on about history, and I want to talk about it. I think a lot can be learned from looking into the past, and I'd like to share what I've learned, and I hope you enjoy it. Dorky is back from hiatus and starting out strong. I was lucky enough to get to have a conversation about Napoleon with my friend Michael Stroud. Michael specializes in military history with special interest in the Napoleonic era, so he is the perfect person to have this discussion with. I definitely had a wonderful time talking about Napoleon with Michael and learned a lot as well. One last thing, a warning about spoilers. Michael and I both watched the movie Napoleon before our talk, and so we freely discuss events in the movie. Having said all that, here's the episode. Hello, everyone. I've wanted to talk about the subject of this episode for a while. Then the movie about him came out, and I knew I had to talk about him. Of course, I'm talking about Napoleon. But as I've mentioned before, I am not a military historian and didn't feel like I could do a subject like Napoleon justice. Thankfully, my friend Michael Stroud is a military historian, and one of the areas he happens to specialize in is the Napoleonic era. He's a historian, a writer, a guest speaker, and a museum educator. And I can't tell you how happy I am to have him as a guest, and how grateful I am that he's agreed to help me sort through the complicated story of Napoleon and discuss the movie about his life starring Joaquin Phoenix and Vanessa Kirby. Michael, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. Always happy to talk history, and especially the emperor.
Yes. So let's get right to it. Yeah. What did you think of the movie?
Well, the first thing I'll say is I am a well-versed cinephile about films. I own probably 500 films in my own collection of just films. I love film. I love the spectacle of film. So one of the things that director Ridley Scott does very well is he knows how to make a big film. He knows how to bring the cinematography and the scale to life. So keeping that aspect in mind, he was able to bring the personality, that big personality of Napoleon, to the big screen. Now, the historian part of me, the one that's read so much about Napoleon, there was, frankly, I had disappointment in how he was represented. And that's a hard thing for me to say because there are many Scott films I love. I don't go to the films to get my history, though, and I think that's important. What I think a good film does is it inspires you as the consumer to be inspired to research more on your own. And I think that's where it's real important that a filmmaker can present a topic or a personality that's so compelling or interesting that you then leave the theater and want to dig into that more. So I'm part of the school where I went into it kind of the opposite. I love Scott and his films, but I was very anxious about how Napoleon would be represented on the big screen, knowing that he's a very complex personality that had a rocket for a life from a really young age, with a lot of being at the right place at the right time in a lot of aspects of his life to shoot to the greatest heights of both political power, but military prowess as well. And then have that penultimate fall at Waterloo in June of 1815. So my overall, and I've thought about a week ago, so I've been processing a lot. So yeah. To kind of take a quick summation, I would say that for me, I felt it was trying to address too much of a big personality in only 2.5 hours. And I think in doing that, there was a lot of great opportunity left on the cutting room floor from a film perspective.
Yeah.
Now, there were components I really liked in general. I thought his attempt at representing the scale of the battles was strong. But I think the biggest deficit to kind of kick off the conversation was just Napoleon's personality itself, I think, was severely truncated and very muted and it missed playing up a lot of his strengths, and it really played up significantly the weaknesses. So I think it was unbalanced in how what he brought to the historical table that we all know from records and letters and everything, that just wasn't there.
Okay. See, I thought that Joaquin Phoenix did really good. I think he's an amazing actor.
Yeah.
And one of the first things I said to my husband as we left the theater was, I know Joaquin Phoenix is an actor. You know, he doesn't mess around. But was Napoleon really that extra?
A couple of things that are important to keep in mind with Napoleon. Napoleon, and they missed representing this completely. Napoleon was famous for his intellect, actually, which really, he wasn't necessarily intellectual in his early school years, but he always voraciously gravitated towards history. Julius Caesar was an icon. He read a lot about the ancient generals of the old world, Hannibal, and math. He gravitated towards math as well, which also kind of really fit in with his disposition towards artillery.
Sure.
So that early penchant for that really just built more as he moved up, as he got his military career going. But his intellect was so prodigious that it was said that at the height of his power, basically, he could work 20 hours straight and only need a few hours of sleep. And he had been recorded of doing this a lot and being as sharp at hour 18 as he was at the beginning of the day. That is a rare feat in today's world, let alone back then.
Yes.
He made almost superhuman efforts to remember basic soldiers' names and one or two bits about them. So in reviews or on the battlefield, he would stop and converse with that soldier, which helped to build that esprit de corps that he fostered. It was really good because he knew it was a relationship. He knew early on that leading men to victory was about the relationship that you had with each of them. Because he saw the turmoil of the revolution and the turmoil of the monarchy, who didn't care about the common person. So he recognized early on, that's the key to success on the battlefield, motivate the men, but you do that through your relationship through them. So that ability to remember and recall, in some ways, almost photographic details of men, but also the battlefield maps. I mean, he could just recall units and where they were at, who was in charge of that, without a lot of support at the height of his time. So they really didn't touch on that at all in the film, and that's a critical component of who he was, and that started early on and carried all the way through. So to me, I was like, oh, his, and there's so many quotes of his chief of staff, his men, his enemies being enamored with that. Tsar Alexander of Russia was basically infatuated with Napoleon, that he
Yes.
could do what he could do. He was almost a sycophant or fanboy almost, actually. It was quite interesting. But some of that appeal that he had both to men at the time, but even now, military people now learn from that it's so do business, that it starts with the people on your team or your force. You build that relationship, you can motivate, and they can overcome great hardship. And he was able to do that time and time again against all odds.
Well, that answers a question that I never really understood until just now, actually, is that when Napoleon was exiled to Elba, he escaped and came back, and the soldiers were happy to see him back. I was like, how? But that kind of explains it. If he had built individual relationships with all of these soldiers, of course, that makes sense.
That whole incident in 1815, that's a very almost mythological occurrence too, that occurred in history when
Yes.
Napoleon returned to France. They did represent him, Joaquin Phoenix did, when he set foot on soil, he kissed the soil. He was reported to have done that. But what they underplayed was when he came face to face with the troops sent by the French king to arrest him. Because the French king, when word got to him, he was so infuriated that he dictated, I want him brought back in a cage.
Oh.
He just couldn't stand it. What was so important, and they totally didn't play this up, was the officer that was in charge of the French troops to arrest Napoleon was Marshal Ney. Marshal Ney was one of the most important officers that Napoleon ever had. And he was with the royalist government at that time. He actually led those troops to arrest Napoleon. And then the famous incident was, is that they portrayed that in the film, but supposedly Napoleon went up and opened his jacket and say, I am your emperor, something to the effect of, are you going to fire on me? And then Ney and the troops said, absolutely not, viva la emperor, and they all switched sides. So they somewhat played on that, but Ney was right there. And that's why, historically, when that word got back to the French king that Ney switched sides, he wanted Ney dead so bad, almost as much or more than Napoleon, that Ney, after Waterloo, when he was captured, he had a very quick trial and he was basically executed by firing squad. Even then, though, as a side note, Ney was reported that even in his execution, he was the consummate soldier for France. His entire career, he was a consummate soldier, all about protecting France, the people of France, as supposedly, even with the firing squad, which he knew a number of the men, he gave the order himself when they were to fire to kill him. But he was that
Wow.
much of a soldier. He refused to blindfold and just said, men, I am Ney of France. I give you the order to fire. So something to that effect. And supposedly that was his death. But that whole engagement, though, when Napoleon returned from exile was interesting because he came with his personal entourage. His mother was actually with him in exile, and she came back with him as well. So that started the 100 days, the famous 100 days. But
Sure.
there was so much that between that point and the film that was so critical to the person he was. That was just, and you can't tell that kind of life story though in 2.5, 3 hours. You really need like a trilogy of films, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, I have to say I'm excited for the director's cut because
Yes.
I've heard that there's like 4 hours movie, and I'm just
Yeah.
so I'm excited.
I'm right there with you. I heard that too. And I was like, I'm very optimistic that that will contain some footage that will help bring more of the true character back that they probably cut for the sake of the spectacle of what it was.
Right. Well, one of the things that I really enjoyed about the movie, I thought that Vanessa Kirby as Josephine was amazing. I thought she did a great job. I have to admit, I was a little bit unsure when the movie started with Marie Antoinette's execution, and she's got this wild hair and she's walking all like, here I am. And I thought, oh my gosh, this was not what Marie Antoinette's execution was like. And so I thought that it would have been a good idea to have Marie Antoinette's famous last words were something to the effect of, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do it, because she stepped on her executioner's foot. And I thought that since the Marie Antoinette of this movie was so kind of nose in the air, that she could have said that, but had it be sarcastic. And that would have been perfect for the Marie Antoinette of the movie, not the real. I thought that Vanessa Kirby did such a good job as Josephine. And something that I didn't know until after I saw the movie was that her husband was executed just a few days before she was released from prison, before the terror was ended. And I really liked the touch of Josephine having the short hair. Please forgive my terrible French pronunciation, but the coif a la victime. Yeah, sorry. Sorry to
That's
anyone
perfectly
from
fine.
France.
No problem, no problem.
Even the way she was dressed with the ribbon around her neck, which was also something that the fashionable women of that time who made it out of the terror did. And I thought that was a really nice touch. And they didn't even really mention it. It was just kind of there. And I was like, I see you. I see you. And I think that's awesome.
She was definitely a strong part of the film. And I know they went into this film specifically wanting to tell more of that story. And that's important to keep in mind that it was supposed to be centered more from the lens of their relationship in a general sense. So it's an interesting way to go about trying to tell a Napoleon story on that lens. Now, he was very much more infatuated with her than she was with him, and they did a good job of playing that off, where she was like, "Oh, you're interesting, but that's about it." And I thought that was interesting because she was very much like that. She didn't really come to have genuine affection for Napoleon till later in their marriage, actually. It was more about security for her and her kids by being associated with him and being a rising star of France, basically. And then he became the emperor. That's a pretty good deal when you're the empress then. But I thought that was an excellent way of how they showed that and how he was more infatuated with her than vice versa. And she was a little bit more aloof with him, like Vanessa Kirby was. But the part I think they overplayed was the opposite end. They almost portrayed him like a sick puppy, constantly after her. And that wasn't necessarily the case from everything I've read over the years. It wasn't to that extent. I thought they overplayed that personally.
When they showed those prisoners being released from the prison, I felt that. I felt that relief and that, like, wow, we made it, you know? And then they had that party where everyone was celebrating having survived, and I was like, yeah, I get it. I thought that was really, really amazing.
Yeah,
And
absolutely.
I really liked the voiceover of Napoleon's letters to Josephine and to his brother. I think Joaquin did a really good job of conveying all the emotion behind what he was saying in these letters. I don't know. I just was like, okay, I see it.
His mother was always remained a huge part of his life from the earliest age. His father had died when he was fairly young of stomach cancer, and his father was a lawyer from Corsica. But his mom was always kind of really the rock of the family. He had like six or seven siblings. He had a big family unit, but she was right there with him, behind him, every step of the way, basically. And even when he was deposed to his final exile, she actually was given basically sanctuary at the Vatican until she died with the Pope. But she was right there with him in his first exile. She tried to get him out of the second one. She wrote repeatedly to Britain on his behalf to lobby them to let him go elsewhere. So it was important she was in there because Maria Letitia Bonaparte was very, very important to Napoleon always.
Yes. And I also really enjoyed that there were certain times in the movie where they would get a shot that was basically like a famous painting of Napoleon. Like, The one that sticks in my mind the most is Joaquin Phoenix sitting in a chair, kind of hunched over. And it looks,
Yep.
it's meant to be like the painting of Napoleon City, And I was like,
Yep.
oh, I really thought that was really interesting and good.
Well, those are excellent. Like the famous scene, the coronation scene where he's
Yes.
crowning. That actually, I've seen the actual painting in the Louvre, and it's 9 meters long. It's immense. It's like a small wall all by itself. And there's 150 different people represented that were actually there in the painting.
Wow.
It's an immense painting, and it's just fantastic. And it's such a iconic scene. And what's really interesting is there's always a lot of myth around certain parts of Napoleon's life. Like there's that story, I don't know if you ever heard it, but in that coronation scene, and they showed it in the film, which is interesting, that Napoleon takes the crown from the Pope and crowns himself. Well,
Yes.
in actuality, it was thoroughly scripted with the Pope, step by step. Napoleon wrote out every step of how long and who was going to do what. So that was all choreographed, all of that was. Because
I believe that.
he was not one to leave things to chance. And actually that ceremony in real life took about 5 hours.
Holy moly.
Yeah, beginning to end, it was a very long process because he wanted all the iconography and all the symbolism to be there. So it was very poignant to the people of France, but more importantly, the international community, that he was the first French emperor and he was going to be a force to be reckoned with in Europe and the world stage. So yeah, it was about a 5-hour ceremony beginning to end. So it was quite elaborate. Every step was perfectly planned from his perspective.
As long as we're talking about the Louvre, and I'm sorry to be jumping around so much, but
That's fine.
my understanding is that while his going through Egypt and Europe, that Napoleon and his men basically took hundreds of ancient artifacts, art and jewels and everything like that, and brought it back to France and put it in the museum, which is the Louvre. I've said this before, but I'm very much on the side of Indiana Jones, and I'm very much like that belongs in a museum. I mean, it did end up in a museum, I guess, technically, the Louvre. So I don't know how to quite reconcile that in my mind, but
Well, you're absolutely right. So when Napoleon's expedition in the late 1790s to Egypt, for instance, when he was sent there with his troops to kind of secure Egypt, but it was more to counter Great Britain and their commercial interests is why he went there. He brought scientists and archaeologists and historians, and it was a French historian. That's where they found the Rosetta Stone. And it took a lot of study from a French historian to finally crack that code. It nearly drove him actually insane because he knew he could feel the kind of connection, and that's a great story all by itself. But Napoleon's very much a patron of the arts because he went to the theater a lot. Him and Josephine did, and his second marriage they did as well whenever he could. So he was a big patron of the arts. So as he conquered countries, he very much, unfortunately, like so many did, they took the most valuable pieces of artwork that they liked, sent them back to France. Now, after his final abdication, there was a big effort between the coordinated French government and the other powers to reclaim those items. So hundreds of them went back to their home countries, if not thousands, after his final abdication, because it was illegally taken even then. So, and there's still efforts to this day. We see on the news now that museums to this day are re-assimilating artwork and statues and things back to home countries after research is done and finding out how it was acquired. So that still is happening now, but there was definitely a major effort at the time after his final abdication in 1815 to get those items back to others. And so that did happen in a lot of ways, but you're right. It filled up the museums of France by, as he conquered each country, oh yeah, this is a great piece. Let's send this back to Paris. It happened. Unfortunately, the Germans did it in World War II. To a large extent, we're still trying to find billions of dollars worth of artwork and priceless items to this day, still from World War II. And that was 70 years ago. So the stuff from Napoleon is a few hundred now. So yeah, it's quite interesting all by itself.
So something else that I also realized while watching the movie is that I'm probably a bit soft for anything Napoleonic, because when Napoleon's horse got shot out from under him, I was like, oh no, the poor horse. But I did check when I got home and no horses were harmed.
Nope. Luckily, there have been filming standards in place for a long time against that. So, oh yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That was a really visceral scene, though, that for a film, that absolutely it looked very real and very, very tough almost to take, right? So, yeah, they did a good job. And unfortunately, in that era, warfare was brutal on horses. The Battle of Austerlitz, which is the penultimate battle of his military prowess, that they showed that scene where they're firing cannons into the lake, the ice lake. Well,
Yes.
that was actually, I think it was the right flank at the Battle of Austerlitz. It was towards the end of it when the Austrians were pulling back, and they showed all these men drowning. Well, actually, there were probably no more than 5 or 10 bodies that were ever found out of that. But it was the horses. They found over 150 dead horses, though, in the lake
Oh.
after that battle. So, and that was a common issue, unfortunately, is that horses were the cavalry. They used pack animals to transport artillery, to bring supplies, logistics. So, unfortunately, that resulted in hundreds, if not thousands, of deaths of those animals. And that's what became a lot of the logistical stretching point for any army, but Napoleon's army as well. I mean, they actually struggled when they invaded Russia in 1812 to secure enough pack animals and horses just to invade. And then they came back with just the shell of what they went in with. But as we saw, they were reduced to eating horses on some of those things that had occurred because there was no way to get food otherwise. So, yeah, that was a brutal reality of warfare in the 18th century, the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century. Even World War I still had horses. So it was still a tough thing.
Yes. So I listened to a podcast that talked about World War I, and the host mentioned that when France went to start fighting World War I, that they were basically equipped and dressed the same way that they were during Napoleon's time. So I thought about that while watching the movie too. I was like, oh my gosh, they were dressed just like this in World War I.
Yeah, that became a lesson in adaptability fairly quick for the powers in World War I because they started up trying to fight the war like they fought all the other wars, right? And but the problem was, as a side note, technology leapfrogged so far ahead, tactics hadn't caught up to that. So they were just mowing down men by the hundreds and thousands with machine guns and then introduction of tanks and then the airplane was introduced in its first combat role. So there was a lot of those first innovations that made the old tactics untenable. It was
Yes.
just too horrific to try to do that stuff anymore. So, yeah, I mean, there were some uses of horses a bit in World War II, but that became more like communication avenues and some different things when there wasn't. When there were shortages of vehicles and stuff like that. And I believe, I think it was World War II also, when Poland had the last cavalry charge against tanks. It was kind of interesting. They had charged against German tanks, I think it was. And that was pretty much the last time that cavalry was actually ever used in war.
Yeah, I'm watching this movie thinking like, oh, look, this is beautiful, like a painting. And oh, and then, oh, the poor horses.
Yeah, that was pretty rough. Even my wife as well was like, "Oh my goodness." I was like, "It's all fake." It was like, "This is Hollywood, so the horse is
Yeah.
fine." Yep, absolutely.
I knew that. But I still had to double check and Google that. I was like, okay, phew. No,
Yep,
no horses were harmed. Okay.
that's right. That's right.
I can feel good about watching this.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, something that I thought of while I was watching the movie, and I've thought about it afterwards. It seemed like he took on like a lot of royal effects and royal attitudes, and I mean he made his brothers king of Italy and king of Spain, and I guess I'm just like Do you think that was more because that would be what was expected of him at that time? Or do you think that was just him being, well, I'm emperor?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. So ultimately, we can never truly understand what's in somebody's mind at the
Sure.
time. But I think there are a couple things that point to that behavior was not out of the norm for who he was. So the first would be one of his historically studied icons was Charlemagne. Charlemagne became king and then appointed others under him, as a So I think that very much fits in line with his elevated status that he became. It's like, I'm a king maker now. I am emperor. I am beyond a king. I have worked hard on behalf of the people of France. So we are going to spread French values as much as we can in Europe. So what better kings to have under you than family too, right? So Jerome and Joseph and all the like. So that's also makes a lot of sense. Familiar contacts, connections are much easier to understand than picking somebody else. So I think as he's elevated in a rapid way, actually, from an obscure artillery officer to Toulon, where he helped to secure the victory over the English, which actually, when that final battle ended, he was actually was wounded by British bayonets, and it actually ended 3 days after he was hurt. But he was the big architect. So that gave him his rise. So from that point on, and then the council, first council, it all just went fast. That I think there's also that something to be said of that old adage, absolute power begins to corrupt absolutely. And it's really hard to stay detached just as a human being to go from where he was because they were really his family life, they were considered minor nobility of a sense, but they were poor. They weren't necessarily rich. His dad was a lawyer, but they were more partisan. They weren't really even pro-French. I mean, at the time he was born, Corsica was basically under occupation, and their name, Bonaparte, was spelt the Italian way until 1796. So he almost converted more to French based on realities on the ground in Corsica for what was happening. So he was never purely French, which is quite ironic that he becomes Emperor of France, but he's really Corsican. So he's not even French. So it's
Right.
quite interesting. And there were all the reports in his life, too, where he never could get the French accent down quite right, according to the aristocratic French. So, and that was something he was bullied on in his schools, in primary school and his military school. So that used to toughen him up early on. He was always fighting against bullies that were bullying him because he was looked down upon. So I think in a lot of ways that psychologically was embedded in him that, hey, I've had to fight back against a lot of bullies. I'm the big guy now. I'm going to call the shots and I'm going to appoint the people that I feel I can trust to be in charge. And I think that when you look at the totality, in a lot of ways, that just kind of par for the course. I just think it fits where his background was. And that's really not out of the norm at all. Plus, that was an era of kings and emperors. Europe was all about that. So it really fit into the image as well that he had to portray, an image of strength that he's in charge of all these lands and he's going to choose who's going to rule under him. And I think that just fit it perfectly.
Something that cracked me up in the movie was when he was on Elba and he was like on his horse being all stuck up and like he was the ruler of Elba, but there wasn't really anything to rule. And then I read that when he was on St. Helena, he threw dinner parties and men at these dinner parties would have to be in full military dress and the women would have to be in formal dress with jewelry and that kind of cracked me up a little bit. I was like, oh my gosh.
His first exile by far was a lot more to his liking by far, because he was effectively the ruler of the island. He really was, and he had his chief of staff, he had his bodyguards, they were soldiers. It was basically he was calling the shots still there. So it was more like a comfortable exile, basically. Now, the second exile, the British were not having that. They're like, you're done. We're going to station a military ship to keep track so you can't sneak off the island. That the governor of the island had to lay eyes on him multiple times every day. And that actually became a game between Napoleon and him. Napoleon, in his memoirs, would write how he would do everything he could to slip out of the gaze of his jailer. So what he would do is he would block the windows with curtains so they couldn't see him. He would try to sneak out of one of the windows or the doors away from his captors to just go to other parts of the island so he could try to be alone. And it was quite an interesting second exile, actually. So, it became a cat and mouse game that even then he was still not going to be subjugated completely.
That's hysterical. And I read that they also, there was St. Helena, which was off the coast of Africa, and then another island that would have been between Europe and St. Helena, that they stationed guards at that island just to make sure that Napoleon didn't escape St. Helena.
Yep. Yeah. There was very real fear that he was going to pull a hat trick, you know, a third time's a charm. I mean, there really was serious fear. And there are a lot of grounds why they should have, because there was a real effort coalescing the year he unfortunately died, that there were a group of ex-French officers and others in America that were going to actually seek to break him out and bring him to America. There was a real plan. He was going to go to Louisiana. They had a place designated and everything. And they were going to bring him to America. And they learned about it. These conspirators learned about his death right close to the time they were going to leave to go there to try to do it. So it's quite interesting. So that was their plan, because he actually was interested in coming to America, because a lot of his ex-officers came to America after the wars. Interesting play.
I was going to ask you about that, because I had read that he had asked if he could be sent to America instead of Elba. And I thought, oh my gosh, what would have happened if Napoleon had been sent to America?
It's a curious what if.
Sure.
You know, it's hard to know, but because there was so much pro-French support in America at that time, he likely would have been set up as a celebrity. Absolutely. I mean, he would have been well off at the least. That wouldn't have been an issue at all. And so, yeah, the British would not be happy about that either. That would have been bad. But it's an interesting tale all by itself. There's a couple of interesting books about that, actually, about the officers that came to America after the war, but also the semi-coordinated effort to break him out, and what the plan was and where he was going to go and what the thoughts were around that. So it's pretty interesting, some material out there. So that's an interesting story all by itself. And it was fairly close. Now, whether it would have succeeded, that's another story, because you know, you have to get to the island, you have to get past the British ships and then get them out of there. But it's hard saying. I mean, you know, it's the what if of history. There's so many of them. So,
yeah, it's definitely, definitely interesting to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So something else that kind of surprised me, and I don't know why I never put this together until I watched the movie, but all of a sudden, there was Talleyrand. And I was like, oh. Because I knew Talleyrand from the XYZ affair from John Adams.
Oh,
and so I guess I always just kind of assumed Talleyrand came around after the French Revolution. I didn't know that he was as involved in Napoleon's rule. I had no idea. And downfall. Because once
please continue. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. He had a longer influence than a lot of people recognize. So really, boy, that would have started, I think it really started for him being prominent in France like 1789 in some form or fashion. And then he just had different positions. So yes, he was very much a politician of the times. Absolutely. Because he served under the monarchy, the revolutionary government. He was minister of foreign affairs under Napoleon, prime minister of France. I mean, so yeah, a lot of different roles. Absolutely. Absolutely. And he played a part in the selling of the Louisiana territory to the United States, which really was a matter of financial need for France at the time, to be honest. Because it wasn't worth trying to deplete French resources more to this far off territory. And they needed the currency, the hard currency, to fund the wars in Europe, which are by far the main stage of any conflict with Britain. So Napoleon's like, yeah, let's make the deal. Here, have this land. I'll take the money. I'll be happy about it. Oh man, that worked out good for everybody in
Yeah.
the end.
But yeah, I don't know why I was so surprised to see Talleyrand in that movie, but I was like, oh, I know who that is.
Exactly.
So my understanding is that the belief is that Napoleon died of stomach cancer, which I didn't realize that his father died of stomach cancer, so that actually makes sense.
Yep.
But they said that they found a lot of arsenic
Arsenic
in
in his
his
hair
body as
strands. Yes. There's been some research done from some historians and some Napoleonic scholars that in their research, and they produced some books, and I have those, that their assertion is that the English doctor was directed by the King of England to slowly poison Napoleon over time because they couldn't take the chance he would escape again. Now, that's their assertion based on the data with the arsenic finds and things of that sort. There's been some contesting of that based on some pushback I've also read countering that, saying that there could be some natural occurrence of arsenic in hair strands based on certain criteria as well. So it's kind of interesting. I know there are different Napoleonic scholars. Quite a few, I think, would side on the fact that he was not poisoned. But it's an interesting case, though. It's an interesting case made, I think, to have an open mind to some extent about that, because obviously there's a lot on face value of a doctor slowly poisoning a patient under your care. A, it's against the oath to take care of others, but does that oath override your oath to your king at the time? It's kind of interesting. You have to always think of the context of the era and what was happening and what were the emotional feelings. That's the stuff that gets lost a lot of times in the discussion of history, because it's really easy for us to sit here in 2023 with our surroundings that we have now and try to impose our sensibilities and our thoughts on stuff. But we can't do that because we do a disservice to what was occurring at the time in that event. So it's an interesting possibility, I'll say. And I know there's been some studies on various confirmed hair strands of his at the time that look like they could point to elevated levels of arsenic, which would be interesting if there's any way to really ever prove that he was slowly poisoned over time. But honestly, it wouldn't be out of the possibility based on they couldn't ever overtly kill a monarch, because that was a kind of against the rules of decorum. You didn't go outwardly and assassinate a monarch. But if you did it quietly and it looked like it was natural, it's okay. Then everybody's okay. So it's kind of an interesting thing. But I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm fascinated by the possibility of that too. And I know some of my Napoleonic scholar friends in Europe, when they hear this, they're probably like, oh, Michael, seriously? But I think it's just interesting to always keep a little bit of an open mind, because data comes forward all the time. New discoveries are made all the time. But the majority, just to reiterate, point to the cancer and that's what he died of. So, but there's always a sliver of open door. You never know. So.
Well, it's funny because a lot of the people I do episodes about, when I read about their death, they're like, oh, poisoning is suspected. It was suspected this person was poisoned. And I never even bothered to mention it because it's like, okay, yeah, no, this person wasn't poisoned, But I think Napoleon's the first person that I've really thought, yeah, it's possible. Most likely cancer, but if
Yeah.
they were going to poison anyone, it would have been Napoleon.
Absolutely. And poison's been a favorite tool for human history, basically. I mean, there's a school of historians that believe Alexander the Great was actually poisoned, which led to his early death at 33. Poison still being used in the modern age by certain major countries against dissenters, wherever they are. It's still used, so it'll always be used in some form or fashion. But yeah, it's a really interesting rabbit hole to go down by itself, to kind of look at the combination of the science and just his mannerisms over time when he was in exile. Like, how did he change? What was his health like? What were the signs of, trying to played a detective of his health, and that's really a concentration on that. So That right there by itself is quite interesting because he was very isolated on the island in a general sense. But really, some of his best relationships on the island were with the little girls of the people on the island. He actually got along quite well with the children and got a kick out of the engagements he had with them and being able to recount stories. And he recounted his memoirs that were being recorded in different events. And just his general thoughts on warfare and those things were pieced together at different points over that exile. So, but it wasn't a long exile by any means. He didn't live long, 6 years basically, and that was it. And it was interesting because they had intended to actually take a photograph of his body too when it was brought back to France, but they were too concerned with a number of factors like exposing the body to the air for as long as it took for the camera at the time. And there were some other things when he was brought back, and just also the possibility of just having it exposed to like people that might try to get in during just a lot of different things. Because I had kind of researched that not too long ago, and I was kind of curious. I was like, well, it's like, you know, they had photography at a certain point before his body was brought back, so I just thought that was interesting. But that was a consideration, but it just didn't pan out, so we never got it. The closest we have is the death mask that they have reproductions of, which is quite interesting by itself because it's very much lifelike, obviously, of what his visage was. He wasn't that old of a man, but his health had been pretty challenged anyways in 1815. He had gained weight, he was overweight, he was having a variety of other health issues, and that definitely affected his mental sharpness that he had for the decades before at Waterloo. So there were just decisions there that he made that he wouldn't have made previously. And his health was affecting that in a lot of ways. So, yeah. So everybody's still human at the end, and that's the important part. It's like, you know, it's easy to see these big personalities as more than human, but in the moment, they are very much human with the faults, the failings, the good, the bad. And that's always important, is to always try to tell the complete story. There's no perfect person, and you know, and he was viewed different ways. The whole stigma that he's so short, well, he was not. He was about 5'6", 5'7". That was at least average height at the time, if not slightly taller. But there's a lot of evidence that that whole short stature came from British propaganda against him. It was the way to demean him, and they called him the Ogre of Europe and things like that. To, you know, the boogeyman, basically. So that whole thing where he's a short guy, no, he was average height. He was fine. There was a lot of little things of that sort that just come into play, and they kind of stuck over time.
I was going to ask you about the propaganda and the fact that, you know, according to propaganda, he was like 5'2". And I remember being a child, my first knowledge of Napoleon was basically from the movie Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Yes.
And Napoleon's this short,
Yep.
angry, you know, and it's funny and okay, yeah, but I wonder how much of that is propaganda and how much. You know, I feel like he got kind of, I don't want to, well, the term that comes to mind is short shrift, which, no pun intended.
Right.
But, you know, he kind of got the short end of the stick. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to make short jokes, but
No, hey.
I
No,
think you know what I'm
but
trying
that
to say.
absolutely, that very much played a major part, because at the time, the number one medium of mass communication was newspaper. So newspapers played a huge part in just getting information around, but also telling the story you wanted to tell. Now, in Napoleon's France, he very much, when he became emperor especially, media was all controlled by him. So he didn't allow dissent in newspapers against him. And his chief of police was Foch, was his name. He was a, that's a character to look up all by himself. This guy had spies everywhere in French society and all over Europe. So he actually stopped, I don't know how many death threat plots against Napoleon because he found out, but he was very much ultimately about himself. But the point is that you control the media, you control the messaging. So Napoleon very much did in France, and then in Britain, it was very much anti-Napoleon favor, because there was a lot of Jacobite leanings in France, which didn't go over well in England because of the Jacobite uprising in the 1750s. So that was not well looked upon, of course. And then all the wars and the pushback and the effort by Napoleon to destroy the British economy through the continental system and all of that. So they were very much, their broadsheets and newspapers were very anti-Napoleon. Plus, he was too disruptive of the status quo of mainland Europe in regards to the royal families, because so many of the royal families were cousins and they're all interrelated. He was breaking that, and they did not like that either by itself. That did not fit the status quo, as it were. But then, if you looked at newspapers in America, and I actually have bought some historical ones at the time from America when Napoleon was emperor, they're very much pro-Napoleon in flavor, more accommodating, more respectful of who he was as a monarch, as opposed to the British newspapers of the time that were very detrimental and very very biting in their word use against about who he was and their descriptions and things that were occurring. So it's always interesting. Newspapers are great historical pieces to look at for events when they're available. And that's something I've started to get more into as a historian, to try to acquire some here or there, to research online, because you can get a really nice kind of moment in time of what a general society is reflective on about how they feel about a person, an event, or what's going on. So, and there's some interesting takes from America for Napoleon and Britain. The French newspapers are tricky because I'm not fluent in French, so I have to use some translation things. But those are always interesting because he controls the message. So it's a good way to get that perspective and kind of see what a society feels about another, for sure.
Yeah, I always try to go into things with the thought that, history is written by the victors. And so you always have to kind of look at things and make sure that you keep all of that in mind and in perspective and realize that, okay, Napoleon wasn't 5'2",
Yep.
but and here we are in 2023 fighting against the rumor.
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. And it's a powerful tool because media and communication and whatever the avenue is, when it's widespread enough, it seeps into the consciousness of the collective population and it latches on. Whether it's true or not, then becomes part of the collective memory. And a lot of times, as we see it in modern society, it doesn't make it true because it was put out there, right? So, I mean, just not in Napoleon's time, ancient times, there's, I consider it the first example of propaganda was the ancient battle of Kadesh between the Hittites and the Egyptians, that it was actually a tactical draw, but the Egyptians were the first ones to record it and stamp it in posterity on their stelas and stone as a victory. And that always stuck as it was a victory. We won a great victory. They nearly lost and it was a tactical draw. But because they beat their enemies to the punch, as we'll say with the communication end of it, they put their PR spin on it. And their people believed it. And so have people for thousands of years until more recent times when historical and archaeological evidence actually point to it was more of an actual draw. It wasn't a victory by any means. And they nearly lost outright, but it was a draw. It wasn't a victory, but that's how it was sold. So that's a great example in my mind of controlling the spin, spinning the reality of it. And really, they didn't win, but they were the first to get the information out. So they controlled how it came out. And I think there's something to be said for that as well. And both then and now.
Yeah, or look at like what the Romans did to Cleopatra.
Oh, yeah, huge, perfect example. Perfect example on that. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and there's, yeah, that's an excellent one. How the denigration of her, and, and yeah, there's so many avenues on that alone. So you can play on. She was highly intelligent, spoke multiple languages. She was a very astute and savvy politician. I mean, there was a lot of things. And they try to downplay her immensely and relegate her to a side note. Absolutely.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to, keep all of that in mind when you look at things like this. And when I didn't know as much about Napoleon going into the movie as I knew about like Cleopatra, or, I'm really into Tudor history. So, I went into the movie with trying to be as open-minded as possible, and knowing that it is just a movie and it is impossible to capture everything. But I'm really excited and will watch the director's cut because I feel.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm excited for that too. I think it's going to bring a lot back into the film that obviously, and Scott's famous for always having a director's cut. I own many of his films that the director's cuts add so much more to the film and make it a better film. So I'm excited too. I'm right there with you. As soon as that's available, I'm buying it because I think it's really going to bring a lot more back into there that he was forced to cut because of time. So yeah, I'm excited too. I'm really excited. Heck, who knows? He might even come out with an ultimate edition eventually. I don't know, but if he does, I'll keep buying them because I want to see every version to see what they can bring back into it. But I yeah, there's so much there that they can play on and add to. And like I said, this person was centered from the lens of the relationship. So
Yes.
there's so much more beyond that, and of course they had to play that angle up more because that was the point of the film, was telling who he was through that relationship with her specifically. But there's so much more depth, and my wish is for anybody that sees the film and that they have an interest spark in finding out who Napoleon really was. There's so many great books out there, and probably two, I have many, but two I would say would be good for anybody interested in Napoleon that they should get are Andrew Roberts' Napoleon book, which is a fairly new book, and David G. Chandler's Campaigns of Napoleon. Dr. Chandler was the preeminent Napoleonic historian for decades, and that book is considered the quintessential book in my mind of Napoleon and his campaigns especially, but it does an excellent job of really portraying Napoleon as to who he was. And Andrew Roberts' book is an award-winning modern book that is fantastic in its narrative as to who he was from beginning to end as well. So I would say those two books are excellent ones for anybody that want to go beyond the film and really delve into Napoleon, the person with the personality and the drive, the prodigious intellect that his foes admired, to the relationship with his men that he could inspire to do seemingly impossible things, to travel great distances on foot when it was deemed impossible to do, or to go in conditions that were horrific, like the Russian winter of 1812, which didn't end so well, but that was part of that grandiose plan. So those books would really help elevate your understanding immensely for anybody. And I couldn't recommend those enough.
Well, I am so grateful that you took the time to meet with me and chat with me about this, and I'm so grateful. Thank you.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It's always fun, especially to speak about Napoleon and the film. So I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And do you want to give your social media for any listeners if they want to follow you?
Sure. Yep. My biggest avenue I use is LinkedIn. So you can go on LinkedIn, type in Michael G. Stroud. I'm easy to find. I'm a regular poster updater on there about every week. I try to do almost every day of some sort. And I am on Twitter, just not as much because there is such a thing as busy. And Twitter takes a lot of time, but I am on Twitter. It should be at Stroud Michael G on Twitter. But those are my two best avenues. And I try to do regular updates of projects I'm involved in, articles I have coming out. And everything related to history. That's my passion and my avenue. So, always happy to share and participate and contribute wherever I can.
I really appreciate you coming to talk to me about Napoleon because, oh my goodness, I don't know if I could have done it on my own.
Well,
So
there's so
thank you.
much. Thank you. It's always been fun.
And that was my discussion about Napoleon with Michael Stroud. I really enjoyed our chat. I'm going to be putting the names of the books about Napoleon that Michael suggested in the show notes. I'll also put links to his social media in the show notes. He's a great follow on LinkedIn. Michael, thank you from the bottom of my heart for sharing your time and your knowledge with me. You're more than welcome back to this pod anytime. So that's it. That's the episode. Thank you so much for listening. You can reach me at dorkypod@gmail.com. Let me know what you think of the podcast. Let me know if I left something out or got something wrong, or let me know if there's something in particular in history that you'd like me to talk about. There's a Facebook group called Dorky Podcast, and all the other social medias are at dorkypod. Join them and be part of our growing community, but also to get extra tidbits about episode topics, like facts and pictures. There's also a link to donate to the podcast on the website and in the show notes, if you'd like. Also, please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you're hearing it. It helps the podcast grow, but more importantly, your feedback will help me make this a better podcast. Until we meet again, friends.